I next met with Dr. Michelle Fennell, and to begin, she commented on some of the key current controversies in Hodgkin lymphoma.
So the prioritization in Hodgkin lymphoma, Neil, is really looking at, for patients who have early stage disease, who don't have a high level of risk factors, actually de-escalating treatment, so really trying to minimize the treatment that they're going to get. The current practice for clinical studies right now is really centered around brentuximab vedotin. Brentuximab vedotin, as generally most would know, was approved back now a few years ago for relapsed classical Hodgkin lymphoma, third-line treatment, basically for patients who had further relapse of disease after an autologous stem cell transplant. Brentuximab was then evaluated in a phase one trial in combination with either ABVD, which was found to not be a good combination because of the pulmonary toxicity, or AVD in the frontline setting for patients who had advanced stage disease. The data that was initially published had shown a very high early PET scan negativity rate. So if you looked at interim PET scans after two cycles, you were seeing that nearly 100% of patients, like in the 96% range, were clearing disease on PET scan 2. We know that PET scan 2, or early clearance of disease, is really a predictor for long-term remission. So there's been prior studies that have been done by Gallimini, Hutchings, and others that have shown that basically if your PET scan is negative after two cycles of frontline treatment, no matter what that frontline cycle treatment is, in this case it was brentuximab vedotin, AVD, but whatever the frontline treatment is, that those patients who go into CR early with their disease on PET scan generally have the highest chance of remaining free of disease 3 years out, and generally the mid 90% range. So that number is truly, we believe, predictive for long-term outcomes. We actually have data that's going to be coming out at ASH this year. So what we did as an author group is that we actually look back now at progression for survival, which was not an initial primary endpoint, at least of the trial. So we looked at it as a secondary endpoint in an adjunctive retrospective study. And the data looks very promising, and it hopefully will be presented at ASH this year.
When do you think we'll have some results in terms of the big phase three in the upfront setting? And how many patients is it going to take? It seems like it would have to be a pretty large study.
So it is a large study, and it is ongoing right now. I believe that it's at least 50% enrolled, but enrollment continues. So we're a participating center for this study. So I've actually treated a number of my personal patients on this trial, and patients are actually doing very well. So this is a trial head-to-head comparison of standard of care ABVD for patients who have stage 3 or stage 4 classical Hodgkin lymphoma compared against brentuximab vedotin plus AVD, no bleomycin. There's, of course, other agents that are following along. So we're actually getting ready to do a trial with nivolumab. So one of the hot topics now for Hodgkin lymphoma for the next wave of development is looking at basically drugs which target really the way the immune system sees the Hodgkin lymphoma cells. And so nivolumab is a PD-1 inhibitor. It's not the only one out there, but there's several now under development concurrently through multiple sponsors. And this trial is going to be looking at basically this anti-PD-1 treatment for patients who have relapsed classical Hodgkin lymphoma, where they've previously have either undergone an autologous stem cell transplant or they've also undergone an autologous stem cell transplant plus received brentuximab vedotin. So basically looking at potentially an approval then for a fourth line setting or for patients who are brentuximab vedotin relapsed and or refractory.
And of course, we are hearing tons about this in solid tumors, particularly melanoma. As you say, there are a number of compounds out there. It seems like pretty likely.
Right. And they're also being looked at in renal cell carcinoma as well. Basically, any type of cancer where you think that the immune system would play a role. In addition, the development in lymphoma is not just restricted to Hodgkin. So it's also being looked at in follicular lymphoma. There's another class of compounds which are somewhat similar in terms of the same types of theory, basically upregulating the immune system, potentially be able to target the cancer cells. And we're doing another trial with another compound, which actually targets LAG-3. So an anti-LAG-3-based drug is also being looked at, basically in the same family. So for the PD-1 inhibitors, the thought process is that you could actually upregulate the T cells to potentially actually see the cancer cells as being foreign and actually be able to attack them.
So getting back to Bevacizumab, I'm curious about your experience in terms of toxicity. Initially, the issue of peripheral neuropathy came up, and I've heard different things from different people. Some people say it's really not a big problem. Other people say it's commonly a problem. What's your experience?
I honestly haven't seen it ever be a problem for a patient to the point where I've needed to stop the treatment. So generally, the way that I'll manage, whether it be on protocol or now off protocol, is that if needed, if the patient, let's say, has, it's usually, when I've seen the issues with peripheral neuropathy, it's usually a patient already has some baseline peripheral neuropathy. So it's usually that patient who might already be in their 40s or 50s. They've had a longstanding history of diabetes mellitus type 2. They have some baseline peripheral center neuropathy, potentially like a grade 1. And so when you treat those patients, those are the patients to me who seem to have a higher chance of developing that grade 2 to grade 3. I will generally hold treatment if needed, and then I will dose de-escalate. So I'll take them from the 1.8 to the 1.2 milligram per kilogram dose level, continue them still at every 3 weeks. There's been occasional patients where sometimes I've need to spread it out further, including sometimes patients who are in their 80s where I've needed to spread it out potentially to every 5 weeks or even every 6 weeks. But I've never needed to actually stop anyone who's been doing well on treatment because of peripheral center neuropathy.
What about other side effects and toxicity? And I see you had this paper in Leukemia and Lymphoma specifically looking at older people getting Bevacizumab. What have you seen in terms of other problems? There was a report at ASH, I think it was 9 cases of pancreatitis. Have you ever seen that?
I've not ever personally seen pancreatitis. A lot of the pancreatitis data has now emerged from the frontline study that's being conducted right now with mirtuximab vedotin plus AVD. A limited number, small number of patients did develop a significant pancreatitis. That data had been reported by Andy Evans at the Lugano meeting last year. I believe that the number was 3 cases of pancreatitis. But in traditional practice, I've actually never personally had a patient who's had pancreatitis. And I'm also treating patients right now actively on the elderly frontline trial, which is the AVD plus brentuximab vedotin trial. And I personally have not had any of those patients, at least to this point yet, have issues with pancreatitis or even amylase lipase going up.
I wanted to ask you about this issue of the elderly. There was a case series reported at ASH of people who just got Bevacizumab.
Right.
Older patients, I think there are a couple in their 90s. And
that's an ongoing trial right now to basically be able to gauge in a patient population where you wouldn't believe that, let's say, that patient population might be chemotherapy fit. So these were patients, I think they allowed patients even with like poor performance status to enroll, what a single agent response rate of brentuximab vedotin might look like. And at least thus far, I think their data had actually looked fairly good in a small number of patients, actually looked quite respectable. I think that the numbers they reported in that poster were somewhere around like a 50%, but early, like 12 patients. So hard to make a lot of big picture conclusions right now. A parallel trial, a little bit different setting, where it's also aimed at answering that same question, is actually the trial that's ongoing right now that Allison Moskowitz is doing at Sloan Kettering. So that trial is basically a trial where she's giving patients in the second line setting, they get brentuximab vedotin alone. They then had repeat imaging studies initially done after 2 cycles, and now she's moved that out a bit further and actually having the repeat staging studies done after cycle 3. And patients then basically have the brentuximab vedotin given in second line settings. So these are generally patients who got ABVD, say frontline, had relapse or refractory disease. So they're then getting brentuximab vedotin on this clinical protocol. After then 2 or 3 cycles, if they, let's say, are in complete remission, they then bypass getting standard care ICE chemotherapy, and they actually go straight on to mobilization chemotherapy and to the high dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplant. She had seen that as an initial look that she had presented data at ASH for about a response rate in like the 25 to 30% range, patients actually being in CR just after first few cycles of brentuximab vedotin. So to me, that is a very promising study because of the fact that if you can actually save, even if it's, let's say, in the end, a third of patients. So if you look at the CR data in the third line setting, CR data was basically 33% of patients going complete remission. Well, what if her final data averages out to be somewhere along there with brentuximab vedotin in the second-line setting, that means that you're saving basically a third of the patients from needing to receive ICE chemotherapy prior to doing stem cell transplant. So reserving yet another treatment option further down the road for them if they have further relapse of disease after the stem cell transplant.
I don't know what the issues are in terms of potentially accessing bevacizumab in that situation because it is outside the label, but I mean, it seems like such a logical extension. I mean, is that something you've tried to do outside of protocol?
So I don't do it outside of clinical studies. So Allison Moskowitz has this study where she actually is giving weekly dosing. So that's one thing to point out. She's actually giving weekly dosing. We had initially looked at weekly dosing. Basically, when this drug was being developed, there were two treatment strategies that were looked at concurrently. One was the Q3-week dosing, which was the one that ultimately moved forward and was approved by the FDA. And then at that time, we didn't know what the efficacy was going to be. So we looked at potentially Q-weekly dosing to see what the toxicity would be, as well as also efficacy. We didn't see that weekly necessarily was significantly better than Q3-week, and that's the reason why Q3-week moved forward. But there was some anecdotal information coming from the trial, which wasn't statistically significant, saying that the patients who were receiving the weekly dosing, who had like these large bulky mediastinal masses, who were short of breath, had B symptoms, that these patients seemed to have very quick clearance of their symptoms. And so for this reason, she's actually using weekly dosing. There's a companion trial that actually Rob Chen is doing at City of Hope. Basically, same theory, same type of trial schema. The only difference is that he actually uses Q3-week dosing. But both of these are still clinical trials. And outside of clinical trial, I don't use this in a second-line setting.
So a couple other questions just in terms of sort of getting an update of what's new with HL. Early stage disease and avoiding radiation therapy. What are some of the key data sets that come out and how do you approach this in your own practice?
So as you know, there's been a lot of data released from multiple, mainly European-based studies at the past several ASH presentations and meetings. So in terms of early stage classical Hodgkin lymphoma, overall, most would say that potentially for patients who become PET scan negative, that there might become a role for emitting radiation treatment. When you look at the data, however, that's been released, there's probably still, although not statistically significant, a trend towards higher rate of relapse for the patients who didn't get the radiation treatment. We estimate when we look at basically all this pooled data together that the increased rate of relapse is probably about 5 to maybe as high as 10%. So you can look at that, I guess, in two different ways. One is that you can say that these patients have a very high curability and that you would be willing to accept that increased risk. Or you can look at it from the converse way, which is generally how we still look at it from an institutional-based practice, which is that if you have a patient who has a high chance of being cured, and generally with modern radiation technique, generally a significantly lower rate of, say, secondary malignancies and other long-term complications, to me, it's still valuable to give that patient the highest chance possible of cure. And so for us as a practice, we still leave in the radiation treatment. So the way we manage patients, if we're not treating patient on a clinical study, is that if they have early stage favorable disease, we treat those patients with 2 cycles of frontline therapy, 2 cycles of ABVD, and then 20 gray of radiation. If we see a patient has early stage unfavorable disease but non-bulky off clinical protocol, we will give 4 cycles of ABVD followed by involved field radiation treatment, this time 30 gray. And if we see a patient who has early stage but a bulky mediastinal mass, 10 centimeters or greater, we would treat that patient with 6 cycles of treatment with chemotherapy, then followed by involved field radiation treatment. So still for us as a practice group, we still leave the radiation treatment in.
Can you talk a little bit about new agents that are being looked at in HL, mTOR inhibitors, IMiDs, lenalidomide, adalimumab, HDAC inhibitors?
So getting back to the second line setting, we actually are looking at right now panobinostat plus ICE compared to ICE as standard of care. So this is a trial that's being led by one of my colleagues, Dr. Oki. And it's an investigator-initiated trial. It's based on initial single-agent data for HDAC inhibitors in Hodgkin lymphoma, generally showing response rates anywhere between about 20 to 30%. So panobinostat plus ICE was initially evaluated in a phase 1 trial. We saw generally a trend towards improvement in CR rate at potentially as high a level as maybe about 20% compared to standard of care ICE. And so right now we're actually, based on that initial positive data, looking at panobinostat in combination with ICE compared head-to-head with ICE chemotherapy. There's also ongoing trials, including those that we've participated in, looking at mTOR inhibitors. So a trial that we've done at MD Anderson is being done by one of my colleagues within our phase one trial group. Dr. Philip Jenku has looked at the combination of vorinostat plus sirolimus. Initially, it was a broad-based phase one trial, so basically patients with multiple different types of cancer types could enroll. The best responses that we saw were actually in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. Mainly, these patients had previously received rituximab vedotin, and often these are patients who had early relapse or had refractory disease to brentuximab vedotin. And we saw overall response rates in the mid-60% range, with a majority of these responses actually being complete remissions. So this trial is ongoing. He had presented his most recent data at ASCO this past year. Patrick Johnston at Mayo has looked heavily at everolimus. So everolimus is another basically TORC inhibitor. It's a single TORC inhibitor. Right now, the next group that are actually following are these dual TORC inhibitors, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But everolimus, similar to the vorinostat plus sirolimus trial, also showed overall response rates in the mid-60% range. The next phase of actually development in the TORC inhibitors are actually dual TORC inhibitors. So I actually have a clinical trial that's going to be opening shortly that's actually going to look at a dual TORC inhibitor, a pill, an oral-based drug, in combination with brentuximab vedotin. Mayo Clinic is also going to be looking at brentuximab vedotin, basically doublet or a combination. So I think that's the next wave of development with brentuximab vedotin. It's going to basically be a series of trials that are going to be ongoing within the U.S. and internationally at multiple different centers looking at brentuximab vedotin combinations. And that's because, you know, the thought process is that for the patients who develop resistance either while on treatment or early relapse of disease, that there's likely another pathway, whether it's the PI3 kinase AKT mTOR pathway that's being activated in the Hodgkin lymphoma cell or otherwise. So if you can potentially give another drug at the same time as brentuximab vedotin, you could potentially overcome potentially a mechanism of resistance to the drug. Because for brentuximab vedotin, we really still don't necessarily know what drives the mechanism of resistance. Initially, it was thought that potentially these patients had high levels of soluble CD30 circulating and that were binding the brentuximab vedotin. That's not the case. Then it was thought that the patients upon relapse after, let's say, having just short disease control with brentuximab vedotin, maybe were losing CD30 on the surface of the cells, and that's not the case either. They actually still robustly express CD30. So a lot of the future work is going to be looking at mechanism of resistance and then doublets with brentuximab vedotin.
What about the small molecule B-cell inhibitors? I wouldn't think they'd be used, but what about adalimumab, ibrutinib, et cetera?
So adalimumab has been looked at within a broad-based phase one trial within Hodgkin lymphoma. There have been some responses seen for some of the other drugs that you mentioned, like you mentioned ibrutinib. There hasn't necessarily been a lot of Hodgkin lymphoma data emerging thus far. You know, once drugs basically get approved, then usually multiple investigators will start putting in applications to do these types of investigator-initiated trials. So I think that likely these types of questions will be answered shortly.
What about the issue of escalated BEACOP in patients with PET-positive disease after ABVD?
So that's basically something that's been evaluated now by Southwest Oncology Group through a cooperative group trial. That trial was led by Ali Press and basically looked at giving patients a transition of care to BCOP escalated if their PET scan was positive after two cycles of ABVD. That trial is now complete. The final data has not yet been released. Patients are basically being followed for progression-free survival. Potentially, that trial might be able to answer the question. In a non-protocol setting, I do not change between ABVD to BCOP.
Let's switch over and talk a little bit about T-cell lymphoma, a pretty complicated subject and not that common of a tumor, so oncologists don't get exposed to this all the time.
Right.
Can you kind of provide, first of all, a broad macro view of how you conceptualize at a pretty basic level the classification of T-cell lymphoma? And maybe we can go through how you think through treatment strategically.
The way that I generally view T-cell lymphoma is really from an importance that these patients unfortunately continue to do very poorly, and that it's exceedingly important for these patients to really be considered early on, a time when they're initially undergoing evaluation for clinical trials. So from my standpoint, in terms of the way that I think about them in terms of management, I generally globally will look at them from either having a lymph node-based disease, so these are the patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, or the mature NK T-cell lymphomas, versus those patients who have cutaneous disease. These could be the patients with mycosis fungoides or otherwise. Within then those broad groupings, I don't necessarily focus so much on treating each subtype of a peripheral T-cell lymphoma differently. I look at them rather broadly. So in other words, if I have a patient who has a peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified or ALCL ALK negative, I really focus on looking at clinical protocol availability. The group that I do treat and manage differently are the patients who have NK T-cell lymphoma. So there's significant publications from Yamaguchi and colleagues that have looked at basically intensive chemotherapy regimens for those who have early stage disease paired with high dose radiation treatment, and for those who have advanced stage disease, just basically the chemotherapy alone. So for a patient who has NK T-cell lymphoma, early stage disease, the high dose radiation treatment is of very key importance. So if you treat those patients, let's just say with 30 gray of radiation, you're significantly under-treating that patient, and they will have a very high risk of developing refractory disease. So for NK T-cell lymphoma patients, really the radiation treatment dose level that needs to be considered is 50 gray, which is significantly higher than what you would typically give. And for early stage patients, we generally look at intensive chemotherapy with DVIC chemotherapy regimen published by Yamaguchi and colleagues paired with concurrent high dose radiation treatment. And then for the advanced stage patients, basically the chemotherapy regimen of SMILE, another intensive, basically ifosfamide, methotrexate, L-asparaginase based regimen just by itself. Then for all the other types of T-cell lymphomas that have lymph node-based disease, the way that I look at them is that I generally will look for clinical trials for any of those patients. So right now we have ongoing a frontline clinical trial, which is basically a follow-up to the initial phase 1 trial. This is currently the Echelon 2 trial. It focuses on comparing head-to-head standard of care CHOP chemotherapy with brentuximab vedotin plus CHP chemotherapy. And this is for newly diagnosed patients with T-cell lymphoma with lymph node disease involvement, with basically a cutoff point for enrollment and the patients needing to have a level of expression of CD30 on the surface of their cancer cells at either 10% or higher based on immunohistochemistry. It basically uses the same cut point that was used for the initial phase 1 trial. Other trials are also coming up. That includes CHOP plus belinostat is anticipated to be opening. So there's also, not here in the U.S., but internationally, a CHOP plus romidepsin trial. Bernard Carfier had presented some of the initial data from this combination trial a couple of ASHes ago. So basically, for that patient population, I really focus on getting them on a clinical protocol. And then if they go into remission with treatment on that clinical protocol, and if the protocol allows, I then focus on doing a consolidative stem cell transplant for that patient population. The only exception and caveat would be, let's say, a patient who has early stage anaplastic large cell lymphoma, ALK positive disease. These are the patients with the good prognostic features, low IPI score, et cetera. That patient I would treat basically generally off clinical protocol. So if it was early stage patient, generally CHOP chemotherapy paired with radiation treatment would be sufficient for that patient. And that patient would be the exception in terms of the patient who doesn't potentially need to be considered for clinical trial or be considered for a consolidative stem cell transplant.
You mentioned the cutoff for CD30 positivity in this trial, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about the correlation between CD30 positivity and benefit from bevacizumab, because kind of from what I'm seeing, I'm not that clear about that at all.
So as you know, it's a very controversial topic, right? So right now, you know, there was data that emerged from, there was a clinical trial that was conducted with now results published for the T-cell lymphoma patients, which looked at brentuximab vedotin in other types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So this was T-cell patients and then other types of B-cell lymphomas, such as large B-cell lymphoma, et cetera. What was seen from this trial is that there was not any correlation between level of response and CD30 expression. Similar data has also now been published by the Stanford group for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. So same issue, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, responses to brentuximab vedotin seem to be independent to the level of CD30. For this particular trial, the frontline T-cell trial, since it was arbitrarily set for the phase one trial, that we're going to define patients' eligibility based on a CD30 cut point of 10% or higher, because this is basically a confirmatory trial of that seeking approval in the frontline setting for this combination, we need to follow the same. But I definitely agree with you that I think this question is still very much unanswered. In fact, there's a trial now ongoing in the frontline setting, as you know, for large B-cell lymphoma, brentuximab vedotin-based combination chemo trial. And within that trial, a particular level of CD30 expression is not required. So while it's tested, there's no gateway for eligibility based on the result.
So just, I'm curious about your best guess. Do you think this is going to play out to be an assay issue?
I think likely. So right now, there's a lot of work being done by the sponsor and others trying to develop a better diagnostic method right now. The main one that's used is the BurH2 immunohistochemistry assay. I'm not sure that high levels of CD30 expression will necessarily predict for best response. I do think that some of these cases where maybe CD30 was not seen at all or was like less than 1%, that some of those patients might have a bit higher level of expression than what was seen.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of management of T-cell lymphoma in the relapse refractory setting?
So that's a challenging area. I mean, all areas, quite honestly, of T-cell lymphoma are challenging for management. So generally for patients who have relapsed T-cell lymphoma, which is a common referral group to lots of large institutions in terms of large cancer centers for patients to be evaluated, the question that I'll first look at is whether or not this patient had previously undergone an autologous stem cell transplant. I'll also look at basically the length of the time of the disease being in remission. So, you know, there's been multiple studies now done looking at autologous stem cell transplant for consolidation after frontline chemotherapy. What seems to be emerging as a consistent message across all of these studies, whether they be European or US-based, is that patients who do the best are the patients who are in complete remission from frontline treatment with CHOP or otherwise at the time of the stem cell transplant. For those patients, they might have disease control at 3 years and the 50 to 55 to even 60% rate. If you would transplant, however, let's say a patient who had no better than stable disease as a best level of response to frontline treatment, those patients unfortunately do consistently very poorly. If a patient comes in and this patient, let's say, has an excellent performance status, I'll generally focus on trying to get that patient to an allogeneic stem cell transplant if they've already done an autologous stem cell transplant. So for that particular patient, I'll generally look at the prior treatment regimens they've received. If they've already received, let's say, a couple of lines of prior regimens, then I generally will focus on clinical studies. So I'll look at clinical studies that we have ongoing at our institution, as well as also I'll look out within the field. So right now, trying to move to like the next phase of treatment options for these patients, we're actually taking agents which are either being evaluated as single agents or they have been approved as single agents and combining them. So right now I have a clinical study that's focused on the HDAC inhibitor, which has already been approved now a couple of years ago for both CTCL and PTCL, which is romidepsin, and giving that in combination with the oral agent, the Aurora A kinase inhibitor, alisertib. And the thought process is that we know that romidepsin generally has response rates that level out to be in the mid-30% range. Alisertib, for some initial data that's now come out from a SWOG-based phase 2 trial, which just looked at T-cell lymphoma patients, for the patients who had PTCL, overall response rate was about 50%. that matches up fairly similarly to company-based trial data, where they also saw overall response rate in the mid-50% range for patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma. So the hope is that by giving combination, that potentially we can drive up the response rate to be at least basically additive, if not even higher than additive, synergistic with the combination. So typically if I see a patient, they've already, let's say, received CHOP and then ICE and an auto locally, I'll generally look at this as a next line.
As long as you mention alisertib, can you talk a little bit more about that agent and where it's been looked at and where you see its future, if any?
So I think its future potentially will be in T-cell lymphoma. So the sponsor currently has ongoing a registration trial, basically where alisertib is being compared to standard of care options like romidepsin, for instance, or gemcitabine-based chemotherapy options for patients who have relapsed refractory disease. It's definitely an attractive agent from a patient perspective because it's an oral agent. And typically, our patients prefer oral agents over IV agents if there's those available. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of interest in seeing what the final results of that large registration trial are going to be, and to see if that drug can now follow the drugs which have already been approved. So romidepsin carries, of course, approval, palitrexate, most recently belinostat, and brentuximab vedotin for patients with ALCL. So the next one up for consideration, I think, will be alisertib.
You mentioned belinostat, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the data we have on that and right now how you sequence it with romidepsin and pralatrexate.
So overall, in terms of if you look at the response rate for romidepsin, palitrexate, and belinostat, they all are fairly equivalent. So, you know, different sponsors might potentially point out nuances, you know, for one having a slightly higher response rate in angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma compared to the others. But when you look at the actual bottom line numbers for response rate, durability, complete remission rate, they're actually fairly equivalent. So the way that I look at the options is that I typically, if let's say a patient, getting back to the patient side, so let's say I see a patient and the patient is status post a prior autologous stem cell transplant, based on whatever criteria, they don't meet eligibility or they prefer not to participate in a clinical trial and they've already received two prior lines plus the stem cell transplant, the high dose chemo. I'll generally look at single agents for that particular patient. So I'll look at romidepsin, palitrexate, and belinostat. Belinostat, as you know, is just recently approved. It basically, in terms of response rate, durability, and CR rate, is fairly similar to the other two named agents, palitrexate and romidepsin. Where it really stands apart from romidepsin is that it has a significantly lower rate of significant thrombocytopenia. Now, if you have a patient, let's say, and they've already had bone marrow involvement or they have a history of having low counts, I think that that's where belinostat potentially stands out compared to romidepsin. I don't think that it necessarily stands out in terms of the actual response rate or durability of response rate data. And then there's a dosing change. So in terms of the dosing schedule for the patient, one might potentially be preferable for one patient and one might be potentially preferable for another. So romidepsin, as everyone knows, has a long infusion time, so like 4 hours. And it's basically given once a week for 3 weeks in a row. When you compare that to belinostat, belinostat's infusion time is significantly shorter, but it's dosed basically for 5 days in a row. And so for one patient, potentially it might be easier for them to come for a short infusion time for 5 days in a row. They'd rather not come once a week for 3 weeks in a row. So I think that also becomes somewhat of a personal choice. For palitrexate, I also use palitrexate. I think that the main thing to keep in mind still with palitrexate is the mucositis. And so sometimes, especially if, you know, a patient that you're seeing already, let's say, is somewhat debilitated from their disease state itself, I think that one needs to keep in mind the mucositis with palitrexate. I can generally manage it by giving a slightly different dosing than what is naturally on label. So sometimes I will dose reduce or I will spread out the doses a bit further. I'll use more of a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma-based dosing schema for patients if they develop mucositis, and that seems to make it more manageable. There have been some initial studies planned, and I think they might be ongoing to look at leucovorin and same agents that you would give with methotrexate to see if you could cut down on the mucositis. I don't know what the final word is going to be on that, but I think that if that would prove to be successful, that would make the agent more palatable for patients to be on because it's definitely an effective agent, but the issue of mucositis definitely is one of concern, particularly for patients.
I've heard people say that globally, romidepsin is better tolerated, and they usually go with that before pralatrexate unless they need a quick response. Agree or disagree?
So quick response, I actually have seen for both. So I don't necessarily see a difference in the quickness of response. There have been some data for pralatrexate, you know, one of these like subset analysis types of data sets, saying that for patients who had, let's say, transformation, where they had MF and they had transformed, that those patients might do better with pralatrexate compared to romidepsin. In terms of toxicity, yes. So I tend to usually go to romidepsin first. Belinostat is so recent to approval, we don't yet have it available in our institutional pharmacy. It's basically on queue to be available in another couple of weeks' time. So for right now, between romidepsin and pralatrexate, I'll generally go to romidepsin next.
What role, if any, does lenalidomide have right now in your practice outside a trial setting in diffuse large B-cell?
So outside of trials, lenalidomide, there's data published for lenalidomide plus rituximab for patients who had relapse refractory large B-cell lymphoma, similar to some data that also exists for bendamustine plus rituximab, basically similar patient population, which does show some benefit. My recollection is that the level of benefit was actually quite reasonable for a short period of time. So I thought that the level of benefit somewhere between like the 35% to even as high as 50% range. So I potentially would use it for a patient who, let's say, is an older patient who's already received, let's say, R-CHOP chemotherapy, and then either RICE or R-MINE, some type of ifosfamide-based regimen, and then they have further disease relapse, and it would be concerned how much they could tolerate additional treatment. It's a patient, let's say, who doesn't necessarily want to be considered for a clinical trial. They live a distance away from us, et cetera. I'll potentially consider either lenalidomide plus rituximab or a bendamustine plus rituximab regimen for that patient.
Have you seen any clinically meaningful responses in that situation?
Yes, I have. So generally not long lasting. So usually lasting maybe like a few months' time, maybe at most about 6 months' time with the absence of transplant. But they have been meaningful. And it's also been a regimen that's tolerated well, that patients have done well on.